Hello and welcome to the second episode in this podcast series all about podcasting. I'm Lawrence from Yada Yada Productions, and in the first episode we defined just what a podcast is. This time we'll be looking at how hard it is to set up a podcast, and we'll be asking that all-important question, how do you measure the success? First of all, let's speak to Adam Rutherford at Nature.com.
How do you know how many people are listening, and how do you know who they are?
We look at the number of times the file is downloaded on a weekly basis, and that's how we judge how many people are actually listening to them. In terms of who those people are, there's no decent way of finding out other than asking them. So we conducted a listener survey. We advertised on the show and on the website and gave away an iPod or two for people to fill out a very short, 10-question survey. So we got an idea of demographics, who, where, and how people are listening. And very interesting results. We found that the audience was considerably younger than our traditional audience, which is, maybe not that surprising. We found that the worldwide distribution was much the same, so 50% in the States, 50% the rest of the world.
How labour-intensive is it to create a podcast?
Well, it really varies depending on what we want to do. We've got two full-time members of the staff working on podcasting now. We still require input from editors because they're experts in their fields, and we're not. We're journalists and producers. But what I tell them is, if you want a very straightforward magazine-style show where we have 5 one-to-one or 2-to-1 interviews with authors, we can turn that around in 2 or 3 days if necessary. But then at the other end of the scale, we've done much more complicated programs. We did a roundtable debate on a new field called systems biology. That was based in a studio in Boston, which we hired out. We had professional presenters. We had 3 people sitting around the table, 2 on the line from Europe, and we cut in some interviews, pre-recorded montage interviews that we'd made earlier in the week. So that's that takes a lot more effort and a lot more thought, but still, turnaround time for that was a couple of weeks.
How have you attracted sponsors to podcasts, and how have you managed to monetize them?
Scientific publishing is an industry which differs from many other branches of magazine publishing in that sponsorship is a key way of generating revenue, right? We don't make a lot of money off subscriptions anymore, especially with the internet. It wasn't a huge leap for the team who seek sponsorship for projects and have been doing that for years to go out and say, well, look, we're actually doing something brand new here. We've got a new way of reaching audiences. Another thing that made it very easy for us to do this was based on some of the results of the marketing survey that I spoke about earlier.
It's probably a good time to mention that Nature.com is part of a bigger entity, Macmillan Publishing. How's Macmillan taken to the success of podcasting?
Nature is part of Macmillan, which also publishes, whose branches include Pan and Picador, who do fiction. We publish children's books. We publish reference books via Palgrave. We set up the podcast and the podcast studio completely independently of them. It was intended simply to allow the science publishing branch, which is Nature, to do podcasting. Soon after, they twigged that we were doing it, and we were doing it in a serious way, and particularly when we built the studio, they noted that there's a lot of audio content from those different publishing arms. And now I'm pretty much inundated on a day-to-day basis from requests particularly from Pan Macmillan to do things like author interviews. I've done a few of them. Things for the website specifically. I mean, the quality of the studio isn't high enough that we can actually do the audio books here, which is a big branch of book publishing. So that's a resource that we still outsource. One of the publishing divisions of Macmillan is Teaching English as a Foreign Language, English Campus it's called. Now, that's teaching English, so the best way you can do that is actually by having it as audio. Now, from next week, they're coming in with actors into this studio to record a soap opera for translation into I think it's Mexican and Spanish, as part of their English as a Foreign Language output. So we found that pretty much every department across the whole of Macmillan is now interested in using the studio. I think if we'd known that earlier, we would have built the studio sooner. But, it's chicken and egg.
Thanks for that, Adam. Now let's cross back to The Guardian and Simon Waldman, Director of Digital Strategy and Development at Guardian Media Group.
How do you think the partnership between blogging and podcasting will develop, and why do you think the two just work so well together at the moment?
Well, I think on one level there's a cultural fit. They're both the sort of very now webby things, and they sort of segue together. The other thing is technically, podcasts and blog posts are actually remarkably similar. I mean, it's a regular submission that can go down by an RSS feed. I think but it's just the general level of an informal tone. A chance to offer feedback, the sort of, you know, the frequency thing, the sort of bits of production. I think it just works really well. But really what you're talking about is one is a very webby approach to audio, the other is a very webby approach to text. Podcasts are a very webby approach to video, and all of them sort of cluster around together online and work really well.
How does GU measure the success of their podcasts in terms of downloads and in terms of feedback and things like that?
We have two sets of measures. One is the downloads we have in a week, and the other is the number of subscribers we have on any given week. So we look at that, both for individual programs and for aggregates. We also see how we do on the iTunes rankings. We follow our iTunes rankings very, very closely. They're meaningful enough when we're at the top. They're obviously rubbish when we're not. And the other thing we look at is the revenue. Podcasts have been a significant revenue earner for us this year, and it's, you know, working with a lot of commercial partners on some very, very, very interesting sponsorship activity. That's very good because it's one of our positions as a media owner is that we are at the cutting edge of what we can bring to advertisers. And so working with them as they sit there and go, what does podcasting mean to me? For us to be able to hold their hand and help them with it, it brings value to both of us.
I think GU is probably the first organisation to get adverts into podcasts and to really monetise this whole idea of making podcasts part of a marketing mix, really. You see all over the site a microsite, which is, you know, I'll give you the Emirates podcast we produced last year, were linked to a microsite, a competition, there was banner advertising, a podcast. Why is it so attractive to sponsors?
About a third of our sponsorship activity now has a podcast attached to it, and I think there's a certain amount of early adopter chic at this stage, and I think that's fine. You know, people will sit there, as we'll talk to an advertiser, we'll go, okay, we can give you this, 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 and we'll do a podcast, and we'll do you some custom content, and we'll promote it in this way, and it becomes part of a package, which makes that brand look very good, and that works well. I think over time, as has happened with lots of things on the web, the sort of opportunities for sponsorship will get more wedded towards existing programming, and that'll work. And then what you'll start to see is you'll get, as audiences continue to grow, you move to a sort of trading model which is much closer to radio. You know, you're basically paying, you know, advertisers will come in for cost per thousands or sponsors or however, and that's our next step. So we're, you know, for us it's about sort of applying sort of, you know, formality and structure and systems to the way we sort of put ads into those podcasts.
Does that mean that Guardian Unlimited as a brand is going to become more like an organisation like Chrysalis or the BBC? I mean, are you looking to make programmes possibly for your platform and other people's platforms?
I think that's probably one step too far. I think, but once we have this, you know, this medium in our armoury, you know, we'll use it as we see fit, and it may be that, you know, in future we'll look at sort of audio as a way to extend our reach geographically. It may be that it's definitely going to be something we'll speak to advertisers about, and video as well. I think one of the things is, you know, previously the only way to have operated in the audio marketplace is to have either, you know, to either have a license or to be able to get commissioned by the BBC. And now there's this chance where a brand such as The Guardian can actually operate on its own terms there, create programming around the areas we find important, and create something which is valuable. I mean, I think if you listen to our media podcast, you know, it's probably the best media show there is anywhere in the UK, on the radio, wherever. I mean, there just isn't a sort of smarter, more switched on. I mean, particularly if you work in the industry, I think sort of, you know, the Channel Radio 4 programme is so sort of neutered by a general audience, it becomes almost irrelevant to anyone who works in the industry. I think that similarly our football programme is fantastic and it deserves the audience, and it's interesting how another newspaper sort of made a huge deal about their football podcast, and which has just fallen by the wayside now. So I think for us it's another tool, and what's happening I think is that all successful media brands are bringing more and more tools into their armory. So everyone is sort of saying, okay, well, we no longer operate just in print or in on radio, or we'll sort of have all of these, we'll have social networks and communities, we'll do video, we'll do this, that and the other. And what you're left with is, as a media organisation, you're defined much more by your brand and your talent and your community of users or readers or listeners or however you define it, than you are by your means of distribution.
In terms of infrastructure and how you set up your podcasting ventures initially, was it a big undertaking for The Guardian?
The hardest thing was finding a spare bit of office space, a sort of extended cupboard in which to build our so-called studio. I mean, it wasn't, we didn't do it for 50p, but it was, it cost us a few thousand quid to build a studio, a half-decent studio, or certainly a good enough studio. And I think, compared to the sort of spectacular array of hardcore technical challenges we face of developing on the web, it's a breeze. I mean, it's much, much simpler. So actually setting it up is not that tricky, but doing it reasonably well takes time and effort. It doesn't just happen by getting, three people into a studio and busking it.
Well, that's it for Podcast 2, but if you want to find out more about podcasting, why not come down to the Corporate Podcast Summit Europe? It's happening on the 19th and 20th of March at the Coq Fontara Hotel in Kensington, London. Visit www.podcast-summit.com/Europe to find out more and register. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.